This is lecture 4 of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner entitled Initiate Consciousness. Lecture 4 is entitled The Mystery of Research in Other Worlds Through the Metamorphosis of Consciousness. I have spoken of the forms and substantialities of the actual metallities of the mineral element, insofar as these things, when man comes into contact with them, have a relationship to his states of consciousness. Before I shall be able to continue this consideration, which I must expand with reference to several metal substances, I must here interject a certain definite comment. It might easily be supposed that what I have said implied the recommendation to evoke a state of consciousness differing from the customary human consciousness of the present daytime life by taking these substances into the body as a sort of nutriment. And when the methods are discussed through which the path into the spiritual world may be found, and men are told what inner schooling, what training of the most intimate sort must be passed through, many persons come to a point where they say, "Indeed, I should be very glad to know something of other worlds, of other states of consciousness, but it is so difficult to carry out the exercises that are recommended to one. The time required is so long." People then make a beginning to be sure of such exercises. But then comes life, so filled with habits from which one is not inclined to part. So the exercises gradually become something that is losing its inner enthusiasm and inner intensity. Little by little the thing is clouded over in the life of the soul. Thus people arrive at nothing. They find it dreadfully inconvenient to have to carry out such exercises of the soul. If they hear, then, that certain definite metallities, let us suppose, are bound up with the other states of consciousness, it is very easy for them to say, "Indeed, this is more convenient. If, for instance, I need only take a little copper in order to be able to follow a man after his death, why should I not take the copper and thus create for myself that state of consciousness which renders it possible for me to accompany the dead man through his entire soul life?" The thing becomes even more insidious when persons learn that in the ancient mysteries the practice was actually carried out in a manner not unlike this, that in the ancient mysteries, of course under the strictest unceasing oversight of those who were initiates, such practices were actually employed. When people learn this fact also, they say, "Why, then, should not these ancient methods be revived?" But in such a question one loses sight of the fact that the bodies of men, even into the innermost parts, were something entirely different in ancient times from what they are today. What then, in ancient times, and even during the Chaldean times of which I have spoken to you during these days, what then primarily was present in man, or better expressed, what was not present? Bear in mind that our present-day intellectuality was not present. Men did not think from within themselves as we do today, but they received their thoughts as inspirations. Just as we are conscious today that we do not create the red of the rose, but that the rose makes an impression upon us, so ancient men had the distinct feeling that the thoughts of things likewise enter into us, are inspired in us. And the reason for this was that the corporeality was something quite different in those ancient times. Even in the very composition of the blood, the corporeality was something quite different. And so it might happen that in those ancient times such metals as those of which I have spoken would be given to persons in extraordinarily diluted doses, we should say today in homeopathic high potencies, in order to reinforce the soul exercises. But you must remember that the whole body was at that time entirely different. Let us suppose, then, that such a person in ancient times, we may say in those Chaldean times of which we have spoken, that such a person was given copper in high potency, and was then advised that before taking the copper he should carry out certain definite soul exercises, as was always the case. Such a person had to train himself not merely for days, but indeed for years, before the copper in a high potency was administered to him. And when this was finally administered to him, he had then learned, through his training and because of his very different corporeal constitution, to feel how this copper in minute particles is a finely disseminated substance in a high potency in him, pulsing through his blood, worked into the upper parts. He had found that when he took copper after this careful training, he inwardly experienced that the words he uttered were in a sense warmer, because he himself had become warm in his larynx and in the nerves that pass from the larynx to the brain. Now, this was due to the fact that in those ancient times a man could evolve, because of his different corporeal constitution, a delicate sensitiveness to what thus occurred within him. If you administer copper in a high potency, under the same circumstances to a man of the present age, it has its effect. Naturally, it has its effect. But its effect is that he becomes diseased in his larynx, and nothing more. It causes him to become diseased in the larynx. This distinction between the ancient and the modern human organization must be understood, and then men will cease to develop an eager desire and craving to transmute the state of consciousness by taking something from without, as was the practice in ancient times, and as was still often done in the Middle Ages. You must understand that for the present age, the only right path for man is to make himself acquainted in his soul with the nature, with the being of copper, to create within himself a delicate sensitiveness to the color of copper, what this is, no matter in what condition copper is found, with the color of copper, what this is when it is polished, to create within himself a sensitiveness to the action of copper in copper vitriol and acid. When a person creates a feeling within himself in this manner, this feeling upon which he meditates, upon which he concentrates, then works in the right way upon the modern man. You may say, yes, but you wrote your book Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment, and it contains no reference to the fact that one should in this way transport oneself into copper. Very true, it contains nothing about this, but there are other things in that book. First of all, this really is contained in that book in principle, not specifically for copper, but for other things. A description is given as to how one should transport oneself into the natures of crystals, plants, and so on. These elementary exercises are given. It is certainly not stated that one should learn the nature of copper, for in that case one would have had to write not a book but a library. But this is not necessary, for exercises are there given. For example, exercises in self-confidence, exercises in concentration in reference to quite specific subject matter. Indeed, these coincide with what I have set forth concerning the nature of copper. It is not stated that one ought to have before oneself the nature of copper, but the following is stated. Seek to take some simple subject matter and to concentrate upon this every morning and every evening. This is the same as saying, in other words, to concentrate upon the nature of copper. That was given as a sole content, which might be given also in reference to the metallic essence. If I say to someone, you should concentrate every morning and every evening upon a definite soul content, for example, in light wisdom shines forth, then, if he really does this, it works upon his soul, and it works just as if I had said to him, learn the nature of copper in all its aspects and concentrate upon copper. Only in one case we take our start from the moral element, and in the other from the purely physical chemical. And for those who are not actually chemists, it is much better to enter the spiritual world by way of the moral. Thus you see how these things must be treated, for the path that one would take into the spiritual world in conformity with the paths followed in the ancient mysteries would be entirely false for the modern man. The right way for the present is that which transforms the external, naturalistically physical element into a more moral way pertaining to the soul. For all connections of man with nature have been changed under the influence of the evolution of the corporeal being of man. The composition of the blood, the fluids and the tissues, the constitution, all these are today unlike those of the men of ancient Chaldea. Ours is a different body. The anatomist cannot detect this. First of all, anatomists work mostly with corpses, and, although it was said very recently at a gathering of research scientists, as a sort of plea for help in behalf of natural science, give us corpses, In other words, the anatomists find that they have too few corpses for the investigation of all the mysteries. Give us corpses. Still, Chaldean corpses will be very difficult to provide for the investigation of these things. And in the second place, the anatomist would discover nothing with the crass means he employs. These things must be investigated by spiritual paths. So then, we have a corporeality unlike that of the ancients, and on this basis something very definite must be stated. Today also we may employ substances in high potencies, metals, for instance. But why do we do so? Observe now that the deeper insight into nature gives us the necessary orientation and direction. If one really knows the human body, one knows that it is modified by all the metals I have mentioned, tin, copper, lead, etc. And I have given you these modifications first through the modification of the states of consciousness. But even in normal life, if I may use this humdrum expression, modifications occur in the human body. Let us say, for example, that we have a modification in the region of the body from which I said yesterday that copper radiates its influence. Such a modification manifests itself in all sorts of disturbances in the digestive organs, in all sorts of disturbances of the limb and metabolic man, disturbances of that part of the human being which is related primarily to metabolism, to digestion, to the absorption of nutriment in the body. Every such disturbance in the human body, which is called an illness, is bound up also with the evocation of another state of consciousness. You must simply grasp this firmly in the full scope of its significance. If you have a diseased organ anywhere in your body, what does this signify? I said yesterday that present-day man has his ordinary state of consciousness in everyday life by reason of the heart. The other members of the human organism have other states. Only these do not come into consciousness. The region of your larynx, together with all that connects the larynx and the brain, has continuously the next state of consciousness which I described yesterday, along with the ordinary state. This region here, that of the digestive organs, has continuously the state of consciousness that leads one through the time that the dead pass through after death. There a person accompanies them always. Everyone experiences the life of his acquaintances after their passage through the portal of death, but he experiences it below the heart, not in the heart. Therefore he knows nothing about this. Therefore it remains in the subconsciousness, the unconscious. If, now, a disturbance occurs in the same region where one continuously experiences the life of the dead during the years after their death, that is, if a digestive disturbance occurs in the form of illness, the state of consciousness down there is modified. Too strong a consciousness appears below the heart. What does it signify, for instance, when one has a certain form of disease of the stomach? In the physical life it means naturally what the physical doctor describes, and what I represent is not in the least opposed to physical medicine. This is fully recognized and honored. In anthroposophy we do not take the standpoint of dilettantism and amateurishness, charlatanry, which disapproves of physical medicine, criticizes it, or repudiates it, and the like. We recognize it fully. Yet, together with the fact that a person has what the physical doctor describes when he has a certain form of disease of the stomach, this person, by reason of this disease, becomes better qualified to follow the life of man after death, immediately after death. What then can one say about this from a spiritual point of view? The disease is, of course, first diagnosed physically, in order that treatment may be prescribed. But one might say, in a spiritual sense, this person has the impulse to accompany those whom he has known after their death, but he has not the capacity to pass over into the consciousness which lies below the heart. He does not know that he is moving in the region of the dead. This is the spiritual aspect of this disease. The person has a stomach disease because he is in the company of the dead too much. But the moment anyone is too much with the dead, they affect him too strongly. Very much enters into us out of that world, which is far more real, as I said yesterday, than the physical world. Now, if you have a pair of scales supported at this point, with the scale pans here, and if the pan on this side sinks too low, and you wish to re-establish an equilibrium, you must balance a greater weight on the other side. If the scales have ceased to be At a balance, you must place a greater weight on the other pan. Suppose, now, that a man has developed below the heart so sensitive a consciousness, though he does not know this, that he goes too much with the dead. This is like a sinking of one pan of the scales. This becomes too strong. Then a weight must be placed on the other pan. How is this done? If there is too strong a consciousness here, one must make the consciousness here in the region of the larynx weaker, for the heart is the fulcrum of the scales. You must therefore make consciousness weaker here in this region. How do you do this? You give the man copper. I have said to you that the modern man is so organized in his body that copper acts on the larynx. But the digestive organs and the larynx are as intimately related as one scale pan with the other. One can be regulated by the other. If the person is given a proper dose of copper, he returns again to health, past the region of the dead, whereas he would otherwise remain permanently in the region of the dead. This is the spiritual aspect of the cure. Therefore, one must say today that all substances, all substantialities, have a physical aspect and a moral aspect, as I have previously explained. The physical aspect could be used by the ancient initiates after long training. For their disciples, as I have said, today they must no longer be used. Today the moral substance belongs to the sphere of the soul's evolution. Physical substance belongs to the doctor. And as regards the moral aspect, the thing to be considered is only that one who knows the physical and has thereby the possibility of entering deeply into the physical aspects of substances is reinforced by a knowledge of their moral aspects. But for present-day knowledge, for present-day practical knowledge, this must be kept strictly in the sphere of the spiritual path. The physical aspect of substantialities belongs to the doctor. The moral side belongs where the soul evolution proceeds. For human organisms have altered even in fundamentals since ancient times. Intimate as was the relationship once existing between the knowledge of the moral and that of the physical aspect of substances, just so intimate must this become again after having been lost. I shall speak immediately hereafter about this loss. But the relationship existing, for instance, between physical medical science and moral science must nevertheless be different today from what it was in remote antiquity. In both cases the relationship must exist, but today it is not the same as in antiquity. Upon the knowledge of such things depends the insight as to which are true and which are false paths into the spiritual world. Now it will aid us in rendering somewhat clearer what I have just developed, if we cast a glance at changes that have taken place during long periods of time in the entire attitude of man toward knowledge. Taking the present period as our starting point, let us go back a short distance in the evolution of humanity in order to observe how differently men then spoke about things in the sphere of knowledge, of research. If today we cast our glance at the great and wonderful progress that has been made in modern times in the knowledge of the forces of heat, of electric forces, but also of forces within living organisms. In discussing all this at the present time, we speak of nature and speak of the knowledge of nature, of natural science, or in England, of natural philosophy. If we take a look at that which is designated as nature nowadays in the schools, even in the lowest schools, in the ordinary primary schools, we find this to be something extraordinarily abstract. It is the sum total of natural laws, as one says, that must be learned. Something extraordinarily abstract, and the abstractness of the thing expresses itself also even in life. You need only consider how abstract are the feelings and experiences today of even the most enthusiastic student of natural science. In botany, for example, he must learn by heart many names of plants and species of plants, in zoology of animals and species of animals. He then forgets these, must refresh his memory of them again and again if he wishes to pass an examination. And when the examination is over, he forgets them for good. After that he looks them up if he needs to use them in the textbooks. One can certainly not say that the relationship of a person who studies botany or zoology nowadays is similar, for example, to his relation to a beloved personality. One can certainly not say this. Today this is not true. Nature is something enveloped in a mist. It consists of many laws, laws of gravitation, laws of heat, laws of light, laws of electricity, laws of magnetism, laws of vapor and water and equilibrium and different phases of equilibrium. Natural science, the knowledge of nature, is what a man knows in regard to stones and plants. Natural science is also what a man says he does not know in regard to the life of the inner organization of the organs of plants, animals, the human being. In short, much that is said today to be known, and also much that is said to be unknown, constitutes natural science, constitutes natural philosophy. But this is something to which one could not give a very warm handshake, for it is all hazy, it is all thinly and abstractly thought out. We strive with all our might today to master this abstraction. Nature. There are many, we might certainly say, who have become somewhat indifferent in reference to this abstraction, nature. We maintain a benevolent neutrality if we do not belong entirely to the side of youth, which is today in discontented opposition to what is prosecuted in the schools as the study of science. We profess a benevolent neutrality. Such was not always the case. And I should like to characterize a little the moods associated with knowledge in earlier centuries. If, for example, we turn back to the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries, or even to the 12th and 13th, but by that time this is true only in slight degree, we come to men whom, if we used this term at the present time, we should call learned men, scientists. We come then to those impressive learned men in the sense of that period, who taught during the 11th and 12th centuries in the very important school of Chartres. We come to Bernardus Silvestris, Bernard of Chartres, to Alanus ab Insulus. We come then to such personalities as belong, I might say, in that time, to the type of the initiate, among other men, to the type of a human being who knows very much about the mysteries of existence, such as the great Joachim de Fior, who was even then an initiate in the sense of the Middle Ages, or to that great personality who also worked during that age, and it was known to the world under the name of Jean d'Anville. I mention these personalities, to whom I might add many others, for the purpose of entering into that time, in order to characterize the mood of the time in reference to knowledge. When one stands in soul in the presence of these men, and they speak about nature, the thing is by no means the same as when we speak of nature today. When one comes in contact today with a botanist or a pathological anatomist or an histologist, how seldom does one have the feeling that the physiognomy with which he faces one has come out of the mysteries of pathological anatomy or zoology. One is much more likely to have the feeling, when one meets today such a pathological anatomist or an histologist or even a physician, that his countenance has come from the dances in which he participated during the preceding day, here or there. Through these countenances, one looks rather into such relationships as this than into what the person has experienced out of the mysteries of nature. Such was certainly not the case when one looked into the eyes of a Joachim de Fior or an Alanus ab Insulus or a Bernardus Silvestris, who lived in that other period of which I have just spoken. Something of a tragic sort rested upon the countenances of these people, something that seemed to say to one, "We live in an age to which much has been lost." Something tragically sorrowful, I might say, lived upon the faces of these people from their profound experience in knowledge. Besides, if one had seen the fingers of these people, fingers which the present-day decadent man would call nervous, but which bore upon themselves the living indication that these people craved again to delve and toil in the ancient mysteries concerning which their countenances expressed the feeling that these were lost. If one had looked at these fingers, one would then have noticed that in these men something was at work which craved to bring back what had existed in ancient times. Sometimes this was achieved. Sometimes they succeeded in conjuring back those ancient times before their students, even though only in shadowy images. One may well imagine, and this is not a poetic picture that I bring before you, it is a reality. One may well imagine the school of Chartres, where even today the wonderfully beautiful cathedral stands, Alanus ab Insulus teaching, speaking to his students about nature, and saying perhaps, "Nature, a being whom he can no longer grasp, who slips away from us when we would approach her. Humanity has evolved powers that lead to other things, but which are no longer capable of grasping nature as nature was grasped by those possessed of knowledge in ancient times. For nature was a great spiritual being who was at work everywhere. There where the rocks have formed themselves into mountains, there where the plants have grown up out of the soil of the earth, there where the stars glitter in the heavens. Everywhere there was weaving an immeasurably great being who presented herself in the form of a wonderful woman weaving. This the ancients saw with their powers of vision. By means of the statements made by the ancients, we can still imagine what nature was, this weaving and working everywhere, which in all that surrounds us, in all warmth, in all the phenomena of light, in all the phenomena of color, in all the phenomena of life, ever lives and weaves. But she eludes us when we seek to draw near to her, for the goddess Natura lives and weaves in all. A goddess, a divine spiritual being of whom man knew. One can know this being in essential reality only when one can behold her. Such were the conceptions that a personality like Alanus ab Insulus made clear to his students in the 12th century in the school of Chartres. But since men saw this goddess Natura dissolving in the mist, together with the living character of all that we discover today as dead and abstract natural laws, since she at once eluded them again, it was this that caused the tragic and sorrowful expression in the faces of those men. Then there were such persons as the great teacher of Dante, Brunetto Latini, who by reason of the unusual karmic accident of a sort of sunstroke on a journey, which was far more important than the grief he experienced because of the expulsion of the Guelphs from his native city, who, because his state of consciousness had been changed by this accident, could still perceive this goddess Natura as he describes her in his book Tesoretto. He describes vividly in a living imagination how on his way homeward toward his native city, Florence, he passed through a lonely forest and came upon a hill in this lonely forest and saw the goddess Natura at work on this hill. How the goddess Natura now explained to him what the human soul is in feeling, thinking, and willing, but how she also explained to him what the four human temperaments are in their reality, how she explained to him what the five human senses are. All this was real instruction to the spirit and the soul, a reality that he experienced as he journeyed back from Spain under the influence of a pathological condition to his native city, Florence. And when he had passed through all this, he then saw the weaving and the real being of the four elements, fire, earth, water, air, saw the weaving and the real being of the planets, the going forth of the human soul into the starry heavens. All of this under the influence of a spiritual teaching that he received from the goddess Natura. All this was as vividly described by a man of that time as is at all possible in the language of today. And yet men then had the feeling, the impression, those others, the ancients, knew this quite differently. Today it slips away from us. We have to get into a depressed pathological state if we wish still to see into these mysteries. Yet there was a tremendous impulse in those men to conjure up again something like the real form of Natura. And observe that when we take this journey backward in human experience, in human thought about knowledge, we then have the feeling we do indeed still stand today in the presence of Natura, but we designate it by a name that is something entirely abstract, a sum total of laws. We are proud when we can in any manner conceive these laws as a harmony. We go back some centuries. We see a living relationship that man sustained toward a divine being who weaved and lived and was at work in all that is manifest in phenomena, the sunrise, the sunset, the warming of the rocks, the warming of the plants, who performs all this in a living weaving and labor. Think what an utterly different science that is. Science comprised the deeds of the goddess Natura. There was also a difference between the mood when the students at Chartres came out, Cistercian monks mostly, and the mood which students have today as they come out of school. That was certainly something different, something more living, something more essentially real. It became altogether living and essentially real in just such descriptions as that of Brunetto Latini, the great teacher of Dante. That this was living we may well imagine, for all the splendid pictures and forms painted by Dante in his Divine Comedy came out of living descriptions by his teacher Brunetto Latini, who had been initiated through a karmic accident, and much besides of what was then taught in such schools as that of Chartres came from such initiates as Joachim de Fiore. The term natura was then used, yet not so abstractly as by us, but for something that is there, that is at work in external phenomena, but withholds itself, something that eludes us. And there was still something else. Imagine, and again I describe to you not a poetic picture, but something entirely real. Imagine yourself sitting as a somewhat mature student in the college. Such was the name, then also, of Alanus ab Insulis. You have shared in what was going on there. The students have been dismissed, and you have gone out with Alanus ab Insulis for a walk, discussing what has happened. What should you then have experienced? Such a conversation would indeed have taken a very unusual form. You might have spoken of the goddess Natura, who manifests herself to us in the phenomena of the external physical world of the senses, who eludes us. Then Alanus ab Insulis, if he had become warm in this soul converse, would have clapped you on the shoulder and said, "If only we still possessed that sleeping state which the ancients had, we could then learn to know the other aspect, the hidden aspect of the goddess Natura. But we pass in sleep into the unconscious, where the other aspect of nature was revealed to the ancients. If we could only sleep like the ancients, sleep clairvoyantly, we should know the goddess Natura." With such words would Alanus ab Insulis have clapped you on the shoulder. And if in such a case one had been engaged in confidential talk with Joachim de Fiore, he would have said after a time, "It is indeed difficult for us, with our sleep so barren of content, which so completely smothers consciousness, to learn to know the other aspect of the goddess Natura, who shapes and weaves there in all the shaping and weaving. The ancients knew her in both aspects, and do you know," he would have said to you, "the ancients did not use the word Natura. They did not say in regard to the being whom we today surmise, instead of knowing much of her, that it was the goddess Natura. They used another word. They used the word Proserpina." This is the truth. This was still known even at that time. The abstract nature we bear in our thoughts is the metamorphosis of what I have just described to you. And what lived in the souls of such persons as Bernardus Silvestris, Alanus ab Insulis, Jean d'Anville, and especially in such personalities as Brunetto Latini, what lived in them is the metamorphosis of that which the ancients beheld in Proserpina, daughter of Demeter. Demeter, the entire universe, Proserpina. It is really quite commonplace when one now utters the newer word Proserpina, nature. Nature, who can spend only one half of her time in the upper world, that is, she shows her physical, sensible aspect to man, who for the other half of life descends into those regions which man attains in sleep, but which he no longer attains at all in modern times, because his sleep has become barren of content. Our knowledge of nature, although today we cannot see this fact, because our knowledge is so abstract, is an imitation of that which lived in ancient Greece, in the myth of Proserpina. The fact that men could then have such a feeling, that this was felt by the persons with the tragic faces whose names I have mentioned, the fact that it could still be felt even at that time, enables us to form a conception of how the paths to knowledge have changed. But the right coloring of such a thing, as I have already said in the first part of my lecture today, the right coloring can be found only when one looks back to learn the form and fashion of knowledge, what it once was. It is not in order that we may devote ourselves again to ancient forms of knowledge, but only to arouse a feeling as to what knowledge once was, that I give such descriptions. If one will hold firmly in mind the remark that Joachim de Fiore or Jean d'Anville might have made, with a hand on one shoulder, "What we now look upon as nature, or what disappears because we cannot reach it on the other side of life, was once Proserpina." And if one resurrects the Proserpina myth in one's soul, for it survives only as a myth, then pictures of still more ancient relationships throng in upon us to meet this impression. These are pictures from the time when there lived among men in their souls, not the abstraction called nature, not the goddess Natura sensed in tragic mood, but when there lived in gleaming radiance on the one side and in tragedy on the other the goddess Proserpina, Persephonia. Aside by me, the reader, Joachim de Fiore, his last name is spelled F-I-O-R-E, in case I'm pronouncing that wrong, and the other person, Jean d'Anville, his last name is D'A-N-V-I-L-L-E. I'm thinking that's pronounced d'Anville. End of readers aside. Back to Steiner. And how did she live in certain periods of knowledge, in those ancient times when she was yet fully alive? That was not the age when Plato wrote concerning philosophy, when Socrates spoke about philosophy. No, it was not that age. It was a far more ancient time, an ancient time when knowledge was something vastly more living among mankind than it was even in the brilliant period of Greek culture. Let us seek to place this before our minds in pictures, in order that by these pictures we may reawaken what knowledge once was in the course of human evolution. In order to throw the right light upon what we have already explained from the point of view of the present age, and shall explain still further in these lectures. Let us seek to evoke a miniature picture, naturally only imperfectly drawn, of that kind of mysteries in which even the Greek philosopher Heraclitus was initiated, he who was called the dark, the obscure, because what he received out of these mysteries had become dark in a later age, dark to men's souls. Let us seek to paint before our souls a picture from that period in the evolution of the mysteries, out of which Greek culture chiefly wrought its creations in fantasy, its creations in the shaping of its myths. Let us seek to set before our souls a picture of the Ephesian mysteries, the mysteries of Ephesus, into which even Heraclitus had been initiated. There were still dominant in Ephesus, of course, primeval forms of knowledge, but these were preserved in Ephesus even up to the time when Homer flourished, and indeed, though in weaker form, on to the period when Heraclitus was initiated. Such ancient mysteries existed then in the most intense vitality. And there were also strong and powerful currents of initiation knowledge flowing into that temple, embellished on its eastern side by the image that has become known to the whole world, the image of the goddess Diana, the goddess of fertility, who in her imaged form expressed the teeming fertility of universal nature. And great mysteries of existence, deeply spiritual mysteries, were drawn down into human words when conversations occurred, perhaps immediately after those participating in the mysteries had received the mighty impulses coming from the cultus and details of the cultus of the temple of Ephesus. There were profound conversations, which continued this when those who had shared in the cultus passed out of the temple. And just at the time when the external world is most stimulating in such things, at twilight, were walking along the paths that led from the temple entrance into a forest where there were wonderful paths, that forest of green trees where these paths lost themselves in beautiful vistas leading to various parts of Ephesus. Such conversations I should like to bring before you in an imperfect picture. It would then come about that one who was an initiate in one aspect of the mysteries of that age would fall into conversation with a student, a young man or young woman. For we must observe that the equality of rights between the male and female sexes was far more vitally felt just at that period, after which it waned, than is the case today. So we may speak of young women students at Ephesus just as well as of young men, and in the same manner. It was just the myth of Proserpina, of Persephonia, in its spiritual form that was vitally present in those conversations. But how was such a conversation concerning the Proserpina myth conducted? First, let us say, there was the teacher, a priest, the adept, who could speak from the impulses he had received about the play of events between beings, and who could say out of his initiation something like this to his neophyte: "Behold, we are going through the twilight. Sleep, which makes the divine world visible, perceptible, will soon begin. Look upon thyself in thy whole human form. There below us are the plants, round about is the forest overshadowing us in the dusk, wonderful in its green twilight. Already the first glittering stars begin to appear above. Only look upon all of this. Look upon the majesty of this, the greatness, but also the sprouting and shooting of life above and below. And then look upon thyself. Consider that within thee there lives and weaves an entire universe. How in all that circulates within thee, in all that has its existence in the occurrences within thee, there is present every moment a plenitude of facts, a plenitude of metamorphoses of beings. Feel how thou thyself art an entire world, more mysterious, more glorious, though smaller in space, than the whole universe thou beholdest from the earth up to the stars. Feel this. As a human being, feel thyself to be a world that possesses a greater plenitude than the world thou beholdest with thine eyes, comprehendest with thy thoughts. Feel the world within thee, inside thy skin. And then sense the way in which thou lookest out of thy world into the world that reaches from the earth to the stars. Thou wilt then be encompassed by sleep. Then thou wilt not be in thy body, in thy world. Thou wilt be in the world thou now surveyest, from the earth to the stars. Thou wilt then have passed outside thyself with that part of thee which is soul and spirit. Thou wilt be living in the radiance of the stars, in the emanations of the earth. Thou wilt move with the winds. Thou wilt think with the radiance of the stars. Thou wilt then be living in thine external world, and wilt look back upon what thou art as a world within. Such might be the talk in those ancient times of a teacher to his neophyte, for the external vision during the waking life was not yet so sharply defined, but such as I have described to you, and sleep was not then so permeated with utter darkness. Sleep was still permeated by experiences, one following another, and when one referred to the state of being surrounded by sleep, one referred to such experiences as this: around thee now is Proserpina, or Persephonia, Cora, K-O-R-E. Cora lives in the stars. Cora lives in the sunbeams and the moonbeams. Cora lives in the awakening plants. Everywhere it is Persephonia's activity which is alive, for it is she who has woven the garment out of which everything is composed. And behind all this is Demeter, her mother, for whom she has woven the garment thou now beholdest as the external world. Parenthesis, he would not have said Natura, he would have said Persephonia or Cora. Parenthesis continued, and behold, if someone remains awake longer than thou dost, so said the teacher to the neophyte, then while thou sleepest, he will see even as thou dost that which appears outwardly to us as the form of Proserpina in plants, in mountains, in clouds, in stars. But that is the illusion, the way one sees these. The illusion is not Proserpina. It is not what she forms in mountains, in plants, in clouds, in stars, but the manner in which thou beholdest is the illusion. Thou wilt sleep through thine eyes, through this wonderful riddle of existence, the eye, E-Y-E. Will Cora Persephonia enter into thee? This was set forth in such living fashion, because it was so living an experience, so that he who was falling asleep did not feel merely, now my power of vision expires, now my power of hearing expires, did not merely feel, now I cease to experience perceptions. But the one falling asleep was aware of how Persephonia dipped down through his eyes into his body, his physical body and etheric body, which were left behind in sleep by the soul and spirit part of him. The upper world one brings into oneself while awake, one is in the underworld while asleep. Persephonia has entered into the sleeping physical and etheric bodies through the eye, E-Y-E. Persephonia is with Pluto, the ruler over the state of sleep and the physical and ether bodies. The activity of Pluto in conjunction with Persephonia, who has dipped down into the physical and ether bodies during sleep, this activity of Pluto in conjunction with Persephonia, was experienced by the sleeping neophyte, who by means of this direction he had received, by reason of the fact that the entrance of Cora through the portal of the eyes had been made clear, had transmuted this into something living, and now in sleep he experienced the deeds of Pluto and Persephonia. This was experienced by him, while his teacher experienced something else corresponding, which was related rather to the world of forms. When they met again, both had experienced mysteries. They might then speak about a plant, about a tree. The teacher would describe how forms are fashioned, for just this had been revealed to him in sleep. He would enter deeply into the subject of the forms of leaves, of the trunk, into the configuration of the world, those configurations which, so to speak, sink downward from above. And perhaps the neophyte had experienced this other, that he could understand what the teacher said, since he himself spoke of the mystery of chlorophyll, of the mysteries of the juices of the plants, which spread throughout the plant from below upward. Thus the discourses wonderfully supplemented each other, while in the living comprehension of the goddess Proserpina, who showed her other side to human beings during sleep, these mysteries revealed themselves in human souls. Thus in those ancient times the pupil learned from the teacher and the teacher from the pupil. For on the one side the revelations were of the spirit by way of the soul, and on the other of the soul by way of the spirit. A conversation that ran thus between men yielded in human companionship, in community of human experience, the highest forms of knowledge. And while one experienced these highest forms of knowledge, as one saw the dawn again coming on, beheld the day star bursting forth in splendor again toward one from the east, gleaming into the dark green forest with its wonderful vistas stretching away in the distance, one was then living for an hour or so in the realm we now call the realm of nature. All this flowed together in conversation. And one was then convinced that all this was association with Persephonia. And one was then convinced that what later embodied itself in the myth of Persephonia was the mystery of man's knowledge of nature. There was a fascination I have been able only imperfectly to indicate to you in the conversations that grew out of the mysteries of Ephesus. This fascination dominated all these conversations. In the conversations, the knowledge of Persephonia lived in full vitality, which was later dimmed away to that for which a tragic sadness rested upon the faces of such men as Joachim de Fior, that which we have today as the abstraction, nature. The paths into the spirituality of man and into the spirituality of the cosmos are understood not when we only point with our explanation to the individual states of consciousness to which man can attain, but when we observe also how in the course of human evolution the states of consciousness have been metamorphosed. How different in character were the forms of knowledge that lived in the conversations carried on by those who had left the temple of Ephesus, those wonderful conversations. And how different in character, again, were the conversations that men held with personalities such as Joachim de Fior or Alanus ab Insulis. And how different are the forms of knowledge we must seek today in order once more to pass from the outer to the inner, from the above to the beneath, to pass again from the inner to the outer, from the beneath to the above, in spirit, in an immaterial way. The end of Lecture 4.